When I first proposed this idea and in talking with Bob and with Mary, I'm being selfish because I wanted to ask a lot of these questions, and I wanted to pose a lot of these things, looking kind of taking how can we get to have some standardization in some microbial analyses, but then as we look at our systems have become much more complex. And so maybe it's harder to go away from some standardization, but as Alan introduced, maybe we need to go back to some old things that we looked at to create some standardization, and then at the same time utilize some newer techniques to hone in on some of the more detailed information that we're looking for within the system. So I kind of want to more sort of stimulate a little bit more of a discussion than anything else, but I have a couple of slides that I want to go through. And then bring up the speakers and hopefully get a good discussion going. So what I wanted to talk about is sort of this idea of sustainable intensification. And as I heard with the pre-conference meeting on organic, there was a lot of the use of this word phrase eco-functional intensification rather than sustainable intensification. And maybe that's what we need to look at is combining these ideas of function. So when I look at microbial communities and processes, is it always kind of taking this look at what the organisms are, or is it taking a look at what some of the functions are and what's happening within the system and how the system is functioning in relation to the organisms that are there? So I like to think of, you know, sort of the soil as the heart of the system and where things begin. And the biology is in and of itself sort of the electrical signals or the impulses that get that heart beating. Without the biology there, you just really don't have soil that's in the system. I like this from Snoopy, you know, that sunlight, air, plants, water, soil, birds, and microorganisms are what you're looking at as you wander through the forest. So even as you're looking above ground, oftentimes we don't take a look at what's going on below ground and the organisms that are there. And, you know, if you don't like Snoopy, then, you know, you want to get a little bit more thinking about, you know, real people. I love the idea that Roosevelt said that a nation that destroys its soil destroys itself. And again, soil is biology and biology is soil. So without having that there, you're basically destroying the organisms that are in that soil environment. And really, for me, a lot of this comes down to the basic idea that those organisms are all starving and they're homeless. And, you know, there are billions of them. We tread on the shoulders or stand on the shoulders of all of those organisms that are functioning and allowing things to happen in the soil system. So, you know, as we're looking at all of these different organisms that are there and the things that they're doing, sometimes when we're looking at how we manage the system, it comes down to just choosing these ideas that are going to fulfill these basic needs that all organisms have, to get food and to be able to have a fairly good habitat in which they can reproduce. Dr. Abbott was talking yesterday, and we were sort of talking about a number of different things, and it kind of struck me in the fact that maybe if in the way that we start designing our systems or the way that we start designing how we're going to do things is that we start with the soil first and the biology first, and then we figure out the tools that we need to apply to these systems. So the idea, you know, was looking at what are all of these systems and how can we share sort of common tools and common techniques across these different systems utilizing livestock and cover crops and organic systems and conventional systems and no-till systems and integrated crop livestock systems, all of those different types of things. Maybe it's starting with the soil and the biology and then pulling out the tools that are going to fit within where you want to take that into the system. So as we're approaching how to design some of the ideal systems, I guess, is kind of what we're looking for. So again, kind of this idea, too, of taking this very simple, we've all kind of seen these different diagrams of the soil food web, and for me it really goes back to, again, this whole idea of where this food web is going to be starting. If you don't have the first trophic level, if you're not getting carbon into the system doesn't function. And I think that that was kind of a theme that came across, too, is this whole idea of how we're managing carbon in the system. And that's that food source that's feeding that biology and creating that level of diversity in that system. So for me, you know, the root of the problem is the root of the solution, and we just need to put down more roots. We heard a lot about that, too, today. different people talking about different rooting depths and utilizing moisture better and utilizing nutrients better and all of those different things that are happening in the system. We've got a number of things that are kind of coming up as we look at soils and soil biology and biochemistry moving forward. Next year is the International Year of Soils, and there's some specific objectives within there. And I think that, you know, I want to kind of bring this too, is that, and bring this into the discussion, is that it falls on us to be, you know, sort of a part of this process and a part of, there was a lot of discussion on, you know, farmer input and utilizing farmer information and farmers kind of being scientists in amongst themselves. And sometimes we, especially, you know, as we're biologists and biochemists, we don't necessarily get out of the lab enough and think outside of what it needs to, of where we need to go. And as we look at these things that are happening on a global basis, I sort of really love this whole idea initially of full awareness as a phrase, full awareness about the profound importance of soils to human life, just that first objective and how we can work to try and achieve those types of objectives as a society and as a division moving forward, and some of the things that we heard today about some of the things we might be able to do to create that. And so there are a lot of different programs that are kind of coming into creation out there. There was a little bit of mention of the Soil Health Initiative that's through NRCS. There's a Soil Renaissance program that's being put together. They've got a strategic plan where they're focusing on things like measurements, economics, education, and research. And again, we need to be a part of the conversation in this. And so that was sort of my selfish reason for wanting the symposium, is because I want to hear what the conversation is, because I want to be a part of that conversation and to get that conversation stimulated, so that when we do look at some of these programs that are getting started, we can have input into that. The Soil Renaissance Group is going to be meeting here in November and December, at various meetings. And this is a group within the U.S., but it's a group that's starting to work on figuring out what might be some of the parameters that could be used to measure soil health and how we can define soil health, tying in, you know, obviously economics into that information and research into that information. But it's also a group that's going to be kind of moving things, some things forward to creating policies. And, you know, those are going to be the things that are going to make the big changes moving forward in agriculture and moving forward into the systems. So we need to be a part of that conversation. And this is just, I like this one. This is for the NRCS Soil Health Initiative. So I love, you know, the fact that they're recognizing and including soil biology in this looking at soil health. And kind of the main themes that they have is a lot of the things that we talked about today. The whole idea of minimizing soil disturbance, energizing with diversity. We talked a lot about crop rotations and cover crop systems and having more diversity in the system, keeping the soil covered, lots of different ways in which we can be able to do that, and to maximize the amount of living roots. And so those are the things that they're kind of moving forward as far as the principles that they're putting forward for how we can improve soil health in the system and improve soil biological activity. Bob did a nice job sort of introducing some of these concepts, so I sort of took some notes. So if there's misspelling or misrepresentation, I apologize. These were notes that I was taking earlier this morning and kind of put these threw these slides in with the break. But, you know, Bob talked about sort of the challenges and the questions that we have for this and moving forward. And so, you know, one of them is what to measure. What is it that we're going to be looking at? And there was a lot of, you know, sort of some questions there with the huge amount of variability in a lot of the analyses that we're having. When you look at microbial biomass numbers, fatty acid numbers, all of those things, there can be some huge levels of variability, which can make it very difficult to be able to do some of the statistical analyses that we want to do and to be able to come out with some conclusions and those types of things. So what are some of the measurements that we can do? And, you know, we're looking at microorganisms. We talk about things on a macroscopic scale, and we look at things from a very macroscopic scale on things, But there's a lot of microsite differences that are happening in that soil environment that can cause a lot of that variability. And I think we need to recognize some of that as we're trying to develop these tools, because oftentimes we find a tool that works and then you put it into another system and it doesn't work. And it isn't that the tool is bad necessarily, it's just that there's so much different things going on in the system that we may not have just one tool, but we may have a series of tools that we might be able to use in order to be able to get the assessments that we want to get. There was some discussion on looking at function versus looking at community. When we're talking about soil biology and biochemistry, there is a lot of debate as to, you know, should we do community analysis? Should that be the metrics that we use? Or should we look at function, how this works in the system? What are some of the things that are going on? How are there changes based on various stresses? How are there changes in the community based on various stresses? And how can the community, sometimes you'll have different organisms that respond differently based on various stresses. So even though it may be the same organism, they just have a different response to those various types of stresses. And so if you look at the community, you may not necessarily know exactly how it's functioning in the system. There's some discussion on, you know, sort of building this resilience into the system, looking at some of the communication between the organisms themselves, looking at communication between the plant and the organisms that are below ground, looking at efficiencies and maybe utilizing some of that as some metrics that we're trying to look at when we're looking at soil biology, is how they're improving water use efficiency or nitrogen use efficiency. And then, you know, two, kind of recognizing some of the things of what are we missing in some of the analyses that we're doing, both functional and community analysis. So then, Bob, another one that he brought up was when to do the measurements. You know, can we link communities with different types of timing of different practices in the system? And should we go by calendar dates, or should we go by different climatic issues or different practices that are being utilized? You know, all of those things can make research very difficult for us to do and very difficult to be able to publish when you don't necessarily follow the same calendar dates or things like that, but you link it more with practices, or you link something with, you know, rainfall events or something like that. You know, recognizing that that might very well be some issues we need to look at. Looking at physiology and, you know, how that might have an impact. So again, you know, sort of some of these timing types of questions. Some questions, you know, that kind of came up within this was not just when to measure, but where to measure. Should where be a question that's involved in this? To what depth should we be measuring? Should we separate things by horizons? Should we separate things by rhizosphere versus not in the rhizosphere? Do we separate? Lynn talked about some data that she had that was based on different aggregate size classes. Do we look at separating down different aggregate size classes and be taking measurements from those types of things? So again, a lot more, you know, kind of questions or challenges that we have moving forward and trying to get some standardization of methodologies. You know, if that's kind of one of the goals that we want to get to, you know, obviously from what we've heard today, this morning, you know, there's a lot of questions that are out there to be able to get that. You know, do we take these whole systems approaches to things, and do we divide things by, you know, a no-till system, a livestock system, a organic system, or do we, you know, kind of combine things into these hybrid systems? Maybe, you know, when we're, again, kind of looking at things and writing up methodologies and those types of things, that we have a little bit more detail about what we actually did, instead of just saying it's a no-till system. What actually was the part of a no-till system? In organic, there's organic no-till systems that aren't the same as a conventional no-till system in the amount of tillage that's done in those systems. So there's a lot of different components in there, but if you just say no-till, what does that really mean? If you just say organic, what does that really mean? So, you know, being able to have that so that we can then have more definition of the systems, and then, you know, maybe if we're looking again at standardization of methodologies, being able to find things that we can apply across these different types of systems. And then, you know, Bob too mentioned about relating this to measurable goals. And a lot of times our metric stick is yield. But, you know, does that always need to be the metric stick? You know, there was several speakers that talked about this whole idea of, you know, kind of what I would call sort of trade-off analysis. So carbon going to the microbial community as opposed to carbon going to yield. And what impacts might that have on the future sustainability and the future yields within those systems? So sometimes when we just have that one measuring stick, maybe it's not really the thing that's going to give us the answers to that. So being able to look at that and look at that from a nutrient standpoint as well. So, you know, there was several speakers pointed out the fact that when you add fertility to the system, it can negatively impact the microbial communities. Well, if your goal is yield, is that something, how can we trade that off so that you could still add some fertility and still maintain or enhance yields, but at the same time maintain microbial communities? It's maybe not a question of either or, but some combination of both into the system. And then, you know, too, the metrics may be sort of a total economic evaluation rather than looking, again, just strictly at yield in the system, so looking at input costs and those types of things. And, you know, we always need to keep in mind, too, the whole social and economic interactions that are happening in there and what producers are going to be doing and what they want to do. And, you know, again, producers can be scientists in and of themselves, and they're trying a lot of different things. And so it was really gratifying to be able to hear a lot of the speakers talk about, you know, the interactions they have with producers and how they're getting feedback and information about some things to test because of what producers are doing. And being able then to also provide them with field tests and with tools so that they can go out there and see this. You know, they have a lot of questions about soil biology and biochemistry. And, you know, if we say, well, you know, but you need to be in a lab to be able to assess this, then it doesn't really, it's harder for them to be able to connect with that. So being able to kind of define some things there. So I guess, you know, again, sort of selfishly going back to what I was looking for out of this program, and I think that it fulfilled many of the needs that I have. You know, obviously, I think for all of us, it gave us more questions than it did necessarily give us answers to things. But, you know, kind of some of the objectives that I had is can we create principles that are going to define some of the activities that we have? So some of the measurements that we're making and why we're making them. Sometimes we just do things because it's the new thing to do. It's the new analytical procedure to use. Well, why do we do it? What does it really matter beyond the fact, you know, what does it mean for the analysis of the whole system? And again, kind of this whole idea, too, of using systems approaches and including things like the soil, water, nutrient, fossil fuel, and human resources, looking at that whole system. That's kind of, to me, a lot of what that whole system idea seems to mean. And, you know, looking at all of these different types of management strategies, and they're all very interactive and multifaceted, and being able to look at that. And then again, you know, just kind of going back to some of the standardization and the commonality of some tools and figuring out what it is that we're going to be doing. So I guess I kind of wanted to use this as sort of a springboard into a discussion. If we want to take a look at that and do we want to start with, you know, what to measure or where to measure or when to measure or how to measure. So I want to bring the speakers up, all of the speakers up, Bob, to come up as well, and, you know, answer any questions that you have. And, you know, if there's something as a speaker that you're like, you know, this is something that I really want to say or something like that, please feel free to do so. So everybody could come on up. And if anybody's got a question.
The perennial trees. The one that I explained was Phytherbia, but
that's for yes. And the one that you use now in Canada.
In Canada, we are using a mixture of those of trees and shrubs, and we try to use native species nitrogen fixers whenever possible. So in our case, I can't give you the botanical names, but I give you the common names, which mean almost nothing you know, buffalo berry, ash, but a mixture. And our agroforestry scientists are using the term eco-buffer. So instead of a field shelter belt, they want to create an eco-buffer for more functions. And but we are, I would suggest that you, you know, look at the agroforestry literature for some species for your area of interest.
Martin, while you are still handy here, one item I was very pleased to see you make mention of a selection of crop varieties that even in organic agriculture, they may have to have organically grown seed if they're certified when that's available. But again, those plants are varieties are primarily selected with inorganic feeding programs. So I'm wondering if in that process of selecting crop varieties for maximum yield under inorganic feeding programs, actually selected for the crop not to have to invest its carbon into the soil to enhance the microbial functions. And a good indicator of that, as you brought up, was the mycorrhizal fungi, that if I know many decades ago, up to four, when I was doing some work in adding mycorrhizal fungi to conventional farming systems, trying to bring them back to get benefits that most of the time did not see any benefit at all. And that's because, you know, probably the varieties being used were not investing in the carbon into the root system that would harbor and enhance the functioning of the mycorrhizal fungus and its associated bacterial or other microbial communities. So if we're approach we're going to take for organic agriculture, sustainable, whatever you want to call it, that if moving away from inorganic fertilizers, a whole new set of varieties may have to be developed to handle that, to work in that system, to make it all function. But not only that, within that system, if you have green manuring versus animal manure, you may have to even select different varieties or sub-varieties within that. So that's a challenge for the plant breeders. So we need to be working with plant breeders in addition to looking at what's going on with soil microbiology.
Yeah, you covered a lot of ground there, and I don't need to add much, except to say that I love your sentiment. Right now it's kind of a black box. There's a number of studies from around the world where people have taken that same population, selected it under organic, conventional, and come up with the variety, and then, you know, check them out, and it's pretty clear from that there is an advantage to having the entire breeding program under organic production for organic production. We looked at mycorrhizal colonization of a whole bunch of varieties from heritage ones 100 years ago, and it's very variety specific. Some of our newer varieties that are really semi-dwarf are very mycorrhizal, so it's very specific. But our approach to have the farmers do the selections for 3 years are to get at that problem of, you know, let's just do it under their system. Then there's options. They can select for 3 years. It comes back to the research station. The breeder can fine-tune it, you know, in a number of ways.
Look at it in that realm if we can start getting some common
Yeah, I guess maybe I'll take a stab at sort of, I don't have the answer at all, but that's my question too, of what are some of the analyses that we could do, and that we need to be, as you said, cognizant too of the whole system and the crops that are being utilized in the system, you know, not just focusing on the soil itself. So, you know, I think that several of you presented some really good ideas on some things that we might be able to use as tools to make assessments and to try and make it more universal. I don't know if anybody else has good ideas, and if anybody wants to put one forward as a good idea of maybe some tools we might be able to utilize.
Got a good idea.
Louise has got good ideas.
I'm not sure it's a good idea, but in response to your question, I think that really what we're talking about is agroecology and agricultural ecology. And that one of the issues that comes up when people are trained in agroecology is you can become very thin across many disciplines. And I think it's a challenge in our educational system where we offer students the opportunity to learn about ecology, but then dive deeply into one discipline or another, and then have classes and field experiences and internships where they can learn to put that into a bigger context and a more interdisciplinary framework.
I'd just like to make a little comment about soil testing. I think it's a good idea to separate the purpose of the test, because there's a lot of complexity in what we can do, and we don't need some of the tests for a farmer, but we might need them for a researcher. So when I've thought about soil testing, I've thought about what are the ones we put in the category of learning and understanding what's going on in soil, and what are the ones that we might use in a practical sense for a farmer. And I think if we keep these two separate ideas, then we can have more clarity, because at the moment there's so much complexity in the set testing, but we don't always need to use the most complex test for some of the on-ground work. Now, one of the things we've done is take this to the extreme level of simplicity. We're actually teaching farmers how to measure the animals in their soil, to extract the soil microflora, a fauna. Now, that might seem like a stupid idea, but the purpose of that test is the farmer can do it at home, and they can learn about the soil a little bit. The test doesn't actually tell them anything about their soil particularly, but when they start to do it, they ask enormous numbers of questions. And that's the value of the test. So the test is not for measuring something, it's for raising awareness and making everybody think. So it's almost like three categories. One is that scientific test, another is, you know, a practical, how much carbon have you got or how much whatever, and the other is what makes people think, because my experience as a farmer has so much knowledge and often is not confident about that knowledge, and we want to get them to be more part of their own development rather than thinking that someone's going to tell them. Anyway, that's just my two bobs.
Are those available in so many words? I mean, are those resources available? I'm not aware of those. I'm in a very resource-poor area. I work with a lot of smallholder farmers that dominate, and that's it. I mean, you know, when I get up there and do the NRCS soil aggregation demonstrations, I mean, you know, the energy just explodes in the room. So, I mean, those things are amazing. But having those resources for distribution, for actual application, and for cube. And I mean, I need all levels of it, you know, for
my participants.
Yeah, like this is simple.
Well, we've put it on the web, so.
Okay, so.
We've made a little book, and it's downloadable. So if you want to email me, I can do that.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah. I think also for the tropical world, or for that world that's not associated with large soil science-based institutions within the ag program, is what, you know, filtering out which tests that said are critical and crucial to making some of these bigger associations. Because, you know, like right now we have to export our soil to the laboratories, and most traditional laboratories are simply mineral laboratories, and that's the only options that we have. And so our programs are very minimized with what we can report, and though we can't do all of the areas of testing, but, you know, having like a, you know, do this first, do this second, and aligning that, I think, would be really helpful for my program in particular.
Could I just make one comment to, in response to your question or your comment? Is it that there are plenty of examples. We heard about one of the, I forget what the farm was called, but I remember it as the Century Experiment in California, in Davis, that Kate Scow mentioned. That's an example. The Center for Environmental Farming Systems, Michelle Schroeder-Marino is here. We have something in North Carolina State. There are examples of long-term investigations that are around the country and around the world. This is where we can make progress in understanding the system, and then there are opportunities for disciplines to interact. That's the key. Michelle's crop scientists involved in soils. We have forage scientists. We have animal scientists. We have breeders, all involved. And so it's not necessarily easy to work together across disciplines, but it's something that we can take the opportunity. And we should make opportunities for that.
I'm from China. I'm from Institute of Soil Science, China Advanced Sciences. 30 years ago in China, we have a very big area of corn and soybean intercropping system. But now the area becomes smaller and smaller because of nitrogen applications. And in one of your slides, it shows that the yield of corn is similar with fertilizer and is similar with the corn with legumes. I wonder how many years can the corn and legume in the crop system can sustain change?
Well, it's a very good question, and thanks for it. The response I showed was actually temporal, so following a legume with a grass or a cereal. But I think what you're explaining is spatially, right? Strips of corn and soybean. No?
Just for this land, and this year we use corn and legumes, and how many years can it be sustained to keep the yield at a stable or increased change?
I'm not capable of answering that question because I don't know the environment. I mean, I think we always have to know the environment that we're working under. It's just like other people mentioned about transferring a technology from one area to another. The concept may work, but we have to know the specifics. And so I'm not sure how to answer it.
Yeah, how many, don't think consider over time, you consider it in
of corn and soybean rotation? Well, I think it depends on the actual. Okay, so it depends on the landscape if it's flat, you know, and whether what type of tillage is practiced. I think in many of our cropping systems, we heard about spatial distribution of drip irrigation. Well, actually, compaction is an important issue. And so, with precision agriculture, I think there's a great opportunity, which we just need to keep the tire tracks on the same row track, and then the biology in between in those inner spaces where the crops are growing, it can proliferate. So I can't really, should I say 125 years? I don't know. I want to give you an answer, but I don't think it's appropriate. Yeah.
I think one comment in relation to that, if you're talking about a corn soybean rotation, that in conventional farming systems that do that anyway, that there is a credit or allowance that a reduction in the application of inorganic fertilizer nitrogen, there's a credit that's given under the assumption that a certain amount of that legume residue is going to provide current season for when the corn goes into that. So they reduce their fertilizer application accordingly in many of those systems, not necessarily all of them.
In our long-term study, if we have 2 years of alfalfa or lucerne and then 2 years of grain crops, extracting grain crops, there's lots of nitrogen. That system is nitrogen and neutral or even builds up nitrogen.
I think we're going to go with sort of one last question. We don't want to go too far over time so that people have an opportunity to go to the next session. So one last question.
There was some comments made about adding carbon to the system. Is there some level of carbon that needs to be like pound per acre or something before it is noticeable? And then also, is it important to do that once a year, every week, every day? Is there some frequency? I've never heard anybody discuss that before about quantities and timing. Is there anybody got thoughts on that?
Well, I guess I'll start, and then I know that there's other people that have good comments on that. One of the things, too, to keep in mind with adding carbon to the soil is not all carbon is equal, and especially if you're looking at feeding soil biology, not all carbon is anywhere close to equal. So, you know, when you're adding carbon to a system, you know, you need to kind of keep some of that in mind, too. And I think that that goes back a little bit to, you know, sort of balancing the idea of adding, you know, things like compost and mulching and those types of things, but also making sure that you've got plants that are growing. And a lot of the things that I've seen, and I think a lot of things that other people have seen, is we've put in, you know, cover crops and companion crops and those types of things, is that there are, can be some pretty substantial gains that come into having a living plant growing in there. And that doesn't necessarily define that you're adding so many pounds of carbon, because, you know, sometimes you add that living plant with different objectives that may, you know, be a legume that's not going to add a lot of carbon to your system, but it's going to be satisfying a lot of the different things from, you know, a biological perspective and a system perspective. So I don't think there's necessarily going to be a magic number, and there definitely needs to be a discussion or a disclaimer put on that in the fact that not all carbon is equal into the system.
Yeah, in our long-term trial, we just observed to maintain carbon in soil, it was needed that we added about 2 tons per hectare a year in form of farmyard manure. And this corresponded about to 1.4 livestock units per hectare. And this was actually the amount of animals which could have been fed by the fodder which was grown. When we reduced the manure input by half of it, so we had a sharp decline or a slow decline in soil organic carbon. But I think, yes, as it was mentioned, it depends on rotation, on climate, on tillage systems and so on, so we just have to adapt it to the respective systems, calling for regular soil analysis, of course.
I would just, the 2 tons per hectare, I remember the number from Ray Almaris from Minnesota that actually showed that it was 2 tons per hectare also in Minnesota as a minimum to stabilize the organic matter. But actually, in contrast to what Christine said, they used corn and alfalfa residues, and there was no difference between those two. So, but I would say that it's management, it's environment specific and management specific. I mean, it depends if you have to till or not. So it's
good question.
With that, I really want to thank all of the speakers and all of the time that they've devoted here to having some discussion and opening probably again more questions than answers into the system. Hopefully, I know that many of them are going to be around for the remainder of the conference, so you know, please feel free, if you find them, to pounce on them and ask more questions. I'm sure they'll be willing to talk to you about that. So thank you very much, and thank you for sticking around.